Welcome to the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast, where you'll hear from inspirational female leaders who are real models as well as role models. Our guests on this show have one thing in common. They are passionate about supporting all women to achieve success. Here's your host, Amanda Alexander, multi-award-winning coach and founder of the Academy for Talented Women.
Hello, this is Amanda Alexander, and you are very welcome to another episode of the Inspiring Women Interviews. Today I am interviewing Jenny Holloway. Jenny is the CEO of Fashion Enter. Fashion Enter is a manufacturing source of excellence and training academy to support particularly unemployed women who've had a curveball thrown at them in their lives and who want a future. And I'll be asking Jenny particularly about this work that she does as a social enterprise within Fashion Enter. I met Jenny at the Forward Ladies Women in Business Award finals, and Jenny had won the regional award for Social Enterprise of the Year. She then went on to win the overall award at Forward Ladies for Social Enterprise category. Jenny and I got on like a house on fire, and I was absolutely fascinated by her story. She started off as a senior buyer at Arcadia Group. She was a selector at M&S. She was assistant buyer at Littlewoods. So for 25 years, she worked in industry and had got to very senior positions within fashion. She then gave it all up, and she's going to be telling us the story of how she gave it all up, what happened, and the business and the social enterprise that she has grown since. So welcome, Jenny, and thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
So let's go back to what I just mentioned, that moment when you realised that you weren't going to work for Marks and Spencer's anymore.
The last job I was with was actually Arcadia, and I was a senior buyer, and I loved that job. You know, it was a very exciting job. At that time in my life, I was about 28 to about 31, and I was traveling the world. I was going to Milan and New York, and it's a great life when you're single and you're just expanding your horizons with your career. It is also a stressful job. You used to have that sort of pit in your stomach on a Sunday because you knew the Monday morning figures were going to be coming through, and you're thinking, you know, I hope I've had a good week. And there's this saying in buying, you're only as good as your last week's sales. And in part, it's true. You know, it's all about figures and performing. And I think as you get older, you sort of start questioning the validity of targets and money, and it's just a lot of pressure. And I think I came to a pinch point when I was working with a certain director, and I was sort of advised to be buying a jodhpur. And I was saying, well, actually, the jodhpurs don't work as effective as the trial I've had, and we've just done this ski pant, and I've made this ski pant really up to the minute, and if you can take this detachable stirrup off. And they say, no, you know, listen to me, I want us to buy this. Anyway, I bought it, and then sort of 3 months later, it was very much, well, why did you buy that, Jennifer? Like, why did you not fight for your stirrup more? And I thought, you know what? Life is a little bit too short and a little bit too precious to worry about the difference between a jodhpur and a ski pant. And I decided at that point I would go and work for myself. And I wanted to have more autonomy. I wanted that freedom of choice, really.
So what did you do?
So I decided... I spoke to my husband, who actually I met when I was 15, so we are very much childhood sweethearts from the same town, which you can probably tell from my accent is in the West Midlands, actually in the Black Country, a small town called Warheath. And I said, I just had to be my own boss, and I just wanted to make my own decisions. So we developed a company called Retro, and Retro was a collection which we wanted to sell to the high street. So we were selling it to lots of different companies, including John Lewis, but also Matalan, because actually a good style is a good style. So it depends on what the fabric you use and the components. So obviously for John Lewis, we would have put in pearl buttons, and for Macro and Matalan, we were putting a polyester plastic button. But the styles were beautiful, and we were always very proud about the quality that we would do. As time went on, the business grew, and sort of before we knew it, we had 10 years of trading behind us. And within that time, I'd had two children, and actually was quite heavily pregnant with a third child. And it was too much. We were turning over 36,000 a week, and this is sort of back in the year 1999, actually. And I said to my husband, I've got to do something here. Like, I'm sort of taking my children around with me to the factories to do quality control audits. And it just wasn't a life. And I think lots of women get that very guilty feeling between work-life balance. It's such a hard thing to achieve. And especially when it's your own business as well. So I decided to contact a competitor, which I'd love to say the gentleman's name, but I won't. Actually, he's no gentleman. So I contacted this competitor, and I said, look, I've got 150 sales force. It was like a Pippa-D type operation where people were selling from home. Lovely, lovely women, you know, women who were so talented all around the country. And this other company also had the same kind of setup. And by now, as I said, I was pregnant with a third child on the way. And over a course of 3 months, we sort of decided that we're going to merge our two companies together. I thought it was a match made in heaven. And actually, I'm a very honest and genuine person. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And I trusted this man to be the same. And you can almost guess what's going to happen, can't you? Because I was so naive, and I've got a business studies degree, and I specialized in law. Not that that helped me. And I just decided that, okay, we're going to trust this guy. We transferred our collections over, our sales force of 150 people were all transferred over. And my husband kept on saying, oh, you know, I feel a bit uncomfortable here. Like, we haven't got much in writing. And I said, oh, you know, well, we've got all these emails, we've got all this confirmation going through, and we sent letters confirming what we'd agreed. Anyway, I had a phone call on a Tuesday night. It was 9:30 at night. And the guy said, I feel very uncomfortable about this merger. And I said, how can you feel uncomfortable? You know, we've done everything that we said we would. You've got all the workforce. We've transferred all the collections over. And he said, no, I feel really uncomfortable. He said, I'm pulling out. And in that 2 minutes of conversation, I felt as though my world had fallen apart, because by now I was 8 months pregnant with my youngest son, who's called Zach. My husband, you can imagine, can't you, the words of, I told you so, you trusted this man, and I told you he wasn't honourable. Our house was tied in to the business, and it was just awful. And my parents aren't alive now, and God love them. They were wonderful people, but they didn't have a penny. So there's no way we just had no money. And I actually can remember going to the DHS and saying to them, I have no money whatsoever. And I came out with a plastic bag of food, and we had a tin of Spam, and I hadn't had Spam for years. I used to have Spam when I was a child with my mum and dad. So that's sort of, I'm 54 now, so that sort of tells you what life was like then. And they gave me a £20 note. And do you know, I felt the richest person ever. Just those little things that make such a difference. We had a jar of coffee, and we had some tea bags and beans and soup. And that's how bad it was. We went from having a good lifestyle to having nothing at all. And I remember looking at council houses with Tim, because we thought we were going to lose our house. And worse still, we went to Bromley, which is where we were. We went to the council there, and we explained what had happened. And I thought we were going to be put into housing, because we had two children with a third on the way, as I said. And they actually said, oh, no, there's no shared accommodation. So you'll have to go into a woman's hostel with your children. Do you know what? It actually makes me catch my breath now. And they said that my husband was going to a men's hostel. I thought that was horrendous. I was actually, I popped my clogs in the council, and I said, how barbaric that you would treat anybody like that because of a third party. And this is this curveball. I say often, life throws you a curveball and you don't know how to handle it, but you've got to flaming well find a way, because actually life is very, very precious. Anyway, so after having a hissy fit, I was absolutely hysterical because I thought we were all going to be split up. Honestly, Amanda, I cannot get over how much that has caught me talking about it. So we came out and we realised we couldn't lose the house because there's no way we're going to be split up. And I came up with this idea. I knew somebody that worked at the News of the World at the time. Obviously, that paper's disbanded now. So I rang him up and I said, look, I need you to speak to the bank manager of the certain bank that we were at to say, I hear you're going to evict this woman and isn't it awful, these poor children? I said, you've got to make a story out of it because I can't lose my home. And God bless him, he did. He rang up the bank manager and said, surely you can't do this to this family. They've done nothing wrong except trust the wrong person. And so they actually gave us this massive repayment plan. And we managed to get through that period and we saved the house. But I got to the point, I was going to lock myself in that house. I was not coming out because I just could not have our family split up. I just thought that was the worst thing in the world. And, you know, my heart goes out to people that happens to. Amanda, it makes you, sometimes when you have that kind of horrendous adversity in your life, you really have an empathy for other people and what they go through. And it's not a weakness. It's just that flaming curveball that gets you sometimes and you just don't expect it. So that sort of explains what happened with that company. And actually, I then changed quite substantially from becoming this go-getter and wanting, you know, the big job and the big house and the trappings that go with it. And I suddenly realized actually money is nothing at the end of the day. Your relationships, your friends, your mental health and well-being. You know, I don't want to be remembered for what I had. I want to be remembered for what I did. And it just fundamentally changed me. And I thought, I was so upset that this man could do that to us as a family. First of all, I wanted to shoot his kneecaps off, and I would have found anybody to have shot his kneecaps off at the time, which is obviously totally irrational. But I remember thinking, the only way I'm going to get over this in my life is that I'm going to stop making people make that mistake that I just did. I'm going to help people to realise that actually there are horrible people out there, and we can work in a nicer way, in a better way that's more ethical and sustainable. I just wanted to do some good. And I know that sounds a very crass thing to say, but actually it's 100% the truth. I just thought it's about helping people.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'd, you know, if you interrupt me, I don't want to talk too much here.
Oh, gosh, no, do. I just, one thing I'm really curious about, you had this amazing idea to call the News of the World and make a story, and that pressurised the bank into giving you a repayment plan. But at this point, so you managed to stay in the house, and that changed what you wanted to do in life and change the direction of your business. But yes. Practical thing was, you were almost due to give birth at this point. So how did you manage to pay your mortgage?
My husband is an electrician by trade. He's an electrical engineer, and he'd worked with Retro with me for those 10 years, which wasn't easy. Husband and wife relationships, not easy when you're talking 24/7 about the business. So he went straight back into employment, and that's how we managed it, because I was 8 months pregnant then and virtually giving birth. So I couldn't do anything, and actually it's probably the first time in my life when I really couldn't do anything. So I was looking after the two boys, who were there's 17 months between Thomas and Callum. So it was a handful. And I think I was at the point of a nervous breakdown as well, so I don't know how we got through that period, but we did. what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, that's for sure.
God, yeah. So tell me, how from having that realization, from having got over the wanting to kneecap this awful man.
Yes.
How did you actually, what was the transition between having your third boy and, is that Callum, the youngest?
Zach is my youngest.
Sorry, Zach is your youngest, you said. Yeah, Zach's the youngest.
Yeah.
So having Zach, what was the next point that you started to, you created another business?
So, I had that. I looked after the boys for a few months. And I think I just had time out, a good sort of 6 months out of working, which for me was a long time because I'd worked all my life and I'm quite independent. Yeah. And my husband knows that, you know, as I said before, what you see is what you get. So he knew that I wasn't really going to be a stay-at-home mom. I love my children with all my heart and my husband, but actually I just can't stay at home. It isn't me. So I had that 6 months of real reflection. My mum's a schizophrenic, and my mum was a schizophrenic, and it was those days of the 60s where One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was very much an accurate portrayal of how mental illness was actually reviewed at that time. You know, you were very much labelled as mad. So I was always very mindful of mental health issues. And I just sort of kept going back to, I want to help people. So one day I started to ring up business support organisations. And at the time it was Business Link for London. I rang up Government Office for London. And I just thought I must have a lot to offer the creative industries generally, you know, new designers, because I just didn't want people to make those mistakes, those horrendous mistakes that I'd made. So that's what I did. I kept ringing up and ringing up and didn't take no for an answer. And then eventually I came across a lady called Olga Astaniotis, who said, oh, actually, I've got a project on at the moment, so I could do with a little bit of advice. So she said, oh, come and see me, we'll have a chat. And she set me on that path of helping people and being a consultant. And I worked really hard because I loved it. I loved the thought that I could take, you know, 10 new business startups who were passionate about their design of garments, but actually they didn't have any business acumen. So I could stop them making those mistakes about selling an order too cheap and where to get the fabric from, and making sure there's something called a sealing process. So when you do a garment with a factory, you know exactly what you're going to expect. And all that was second nature for me because that's what I'd done professionally. And so it was just so incredibly rewarding. And then I think that my name got bandied about a bit with, at the time, the London Development Agency. And they started a new project called the London Fashion Forum, which I was a project manager. And it was fantastic. I don't realise how fantastic it was to be paid to do a job that I really loved. And that 3-year funding, and I worked with a wonderful man called David Jones, who I'm still very friendly with. He was the director, I was the project manager. We had funding for 3 years, and it was so successful we had funding for another 3 years, which took us up to 2006. And it just made me realise I could never go back into that commercial world again, because, as I keep saying, life is very, very precious. So the funding finished, and it was a bit, well, what do I do now? Because certainly one thing's for sure, I feel as though I would be too old to go back into buying anyway, and that's not where I wanted my life to go. So I thought, I know, I'm going to carry on, and I'm going to do social work, this sort of social enterprise work for young designers. And my husband was not happy about this because he said, Jennifer, you know, I know what you like and you'll give it 100% and you've got no money to invest into a business, which is true. And actually, I had £8,000 worth of shares. That's all I had. And he said, so I would personally prefer it if you go back to being a consultant as you were with the London Fashion Forum and find new projects. And I said, well, I don't think there's any more money around and I'm not prepared to wait and spend, you know, another year trying to write a bid to get more money. I said, I want to do something. And I said, I'd found a shop. There's a lovely man called David Parham, who was at Central in Croydon. And I'd found this little shop that was tucked away, called a secondary location, very grey, very dingy. And I persuaded this man to let me have the shop for free, basically. And I said, I'm going to drive footfall to here. I'm going to open a shop for young designers, because one of the biggest problems for very talented young designers is that they've got no way of selling their products. Mm. So I said, I would take on 20 of these designers. And we'd sell the garments for them. We would take a commission and we would start the business that way. Mm. And Tim said, no, you're not doing it, Jennifer, because I know what's going to happen. It's going to be a disaster. And he said, right, I'm going to, he went skiing for a week. And when he got back, I'd opened the shop, to which he was hysterical. So it was absolutely hysterical. And
not with laughter.
No, good God, no. He was apoplectic with rage. Apoplectic. Because he said, why would you do that? Why would you have all that risk? And like, you're now going really into business. Even though it was a social enterprise, he said, it's still a business. You have no money and you're going to have to fund this shop yourself. And you know, it was one of those times when, again, I had the 8,000 shares went into the shop fit, so we had no money. And I bought a bike, which actually was ridiculous, because I decided I live about 4 miles away from Croydon. So I decided I was going to cycle there and back, because actually we really were down to pennies again. The boys were growing up, we really didn't have that much money, and I felt quite bad actually. That I'd gone against my husband's wishes, and it was such a big jump into the unknown. Anyway, I only cycled there 3 times because it was just too far, and I'm just too old. And I thought I was going to get run over by the trams as well, so that was a bit of a disaster. But it shows you, you know, if you really want to do something, you know, if it's in your heart and it sort of gets into your soul and it gets in under your skin. You know, I can't ignore that. You know, what is it? Is it a calling? Is it a desire? I don't know. All I know is I just think life's so precious, and why be miserable or unhappy in what you're doing? Because there's a whole world out there, and we shouldn't be frightened to fail. And many, many years ago, I read a book and it said, feel the fear and do it anyway. And actually, I live my life like that. Sometimes it's wrong, sometimes it's right, but at least it's my life and I'm making those decisions. So the shop was really, really hard work. So my husband was right. However, we were there a good 4 years in total, and we traded and we kept on doing little projects and little initiatives, and our database grew. And actually that's when we also got fashioncapital.co.uk, which is a government website. That they put 2.1 million into that website, and there was no real exit plan, which I thought was awful, because I've sort of spent 6 years of my life building up that website. And actually, very kindly, we were allowed to continue with that website, which we have maintained to this day. And we have a 80,000 database in total on that website. So we're very proud to be able to provide really good quality information to help designers free of charge on how their business should be run and trends, etc. So that's really how the company started and how we developed. Do you want me to continue with the rest of where we are today?
Yes.
So one of the reoccurring problems we had with the designers was making up samples. So we would recommend a CMT, which means cut, make and trim unit. We would say, go and use so-and-so. They've got a good reputation. And I hate letting people down. You know, my dad used to say to me, if you haven't got your word in life, Jennifer, you've got nothing. And I really believe that. I believe your word should be your bond. And I try very, very hard never to lie. People sometimes may find me blunt, but I'm not a liar. And the thought that these poor girls were going out and using these sample units that we had recommended, and they would ring me up in floods of tears saying, well, you told me they were good and they've made such a mess and I spent all my money. I just felt shockingly awful. So I decided to open a little sampling unit myself because I could guarantee then that everything would be done as beautifully as it could be. God love a lady called Kasia, who is with us today. I found this lady called Kasia, a Polish lady, who is so technically supreme. I asked her if we could find just a little unit, and she had just three machinists. So there was just the five of us. And Jenny Sutton, actually, Jenny's been with me as an intern when we were at Croydon. So Jenny was still with us and is just like my right-hand person, a lovely lady. So we opened up this sampling unit and it was like this massive relief that we would never let anybody down. And we didn't. And we just kept growing and growing. We got a good reputation very quickly for being honourable. Now, if people came to us and said, I want 10 of those, I'd actually say, don't do 10 because you don't know if it's going to sell. Well, you just make one and then photograph it. You get the money in. And then if it sells, we'll make it to order rather than you wasting all your money, which I know is unheard of in sort of like commercial fields. But that's how we built up the company. I don't want to take people's money unless I know that they're going to make some money too. So we grew and we started growing, and then sort of the machinists. We got to about 20 machinists in total. And then I had this idea. I kept watching ASOS, which at the time was called As Seen on Screen. I kept watching them grow, and I was thinking, oh, what a clever idea that is, really. So I contacted the owner of the company, a guy called Nick Robertson, and I said, look, I've got all these wonderful designers. Why don't you have a page of these designers? Because they're just so exciting. And he said, oh, what a great idea. I'm happy to support you with that. So suddenly they were getting orders of 50 and 100 and 300 if it was being sold out. And we were now struggling to keep up with that momentum of making not samples but production. So I went back to Nick R and I said, do you know what? You need a UK factory, because actually it's all about your business model is all about fast track production. And I remember when I was at Marks and Spencer's and we used to go and see SR Gent in Barnsley and Burnham in Nottingham. And these factories were fantastic. You know, they're not sweatshops. You know, these were middle-aged women who were proud to be a seamstress. And their daughters would come in. It was all succession planning. It was a craftsmanship. And I said, why can't we do that? Why can't we bring back a bit of garment manufacturing back to the UK? And he said, actually, I like that idea. What a good idea. And then listen to this. Now, isn't this absolutely amazing? I went to do a presentation to Nick R and a guy called Nick Byton, who is now actually the CEO of ASOS. And I did this presentation about why they needed a factory. And then I had a loan of £230,000 to open up a factory. Oh, wow. Isn't that amazing? I mean, how often would that ever happen in your life? Yeah. And the truth is, whilst it was amazing to get the money, actually going from a little sampling unit where, you know, one woman is making one garment, she's making it beautifully and you can control it, going from that to a factory where you need a minimum of 30 people, you need cutters, you need finishers, pattern people, graders. It was actually a completely different business model. And I was very naive and very, very foolish to think it was going to be an easy transition. And probably the first 6 months, I probably cried most days because I was so out of my comfort zone. I didn't know really what I was doing whatsoever. And I just thought, this is probably the worst, one of the worst situations professionally in my life, because I just, you know, I hate that letting of people down, and they entrusted me with all that money. Oh God, I just felt awful. Anyway, the one thing I never compromised was quality, and I never lied. I told them about the weaknesses of the company and my weaknesses as the CEO, but I didn't give up. There were many times when I used to walk my dog, which was a collie, when I just tried to work things out and go for long walks. And also my children were still young. You know, it was really a stressful period. But you just have to find a way in life. I kept falling over. I would brush myself down and I'd go back in there with a smile, slightly a grimace, not necessarily a smile, but I would go back in there. And, you know, bit by bit, I learned lots about my own weaknesses and strengths, and surrounded myself by wonderful people like Kasia. There's a guy called Chris Toomer who is with me today as well. He's just my right-hand person in the factory. And we never submitted a bad quality garment. And, you know, we could have done so many sharp things. We could have subcontracted out to another factory. We could have paid machinists illegally, like cash. But I kept on saying, I cannot look at myself in the mirror if I work like that. That's worse, because it's, as I keep saying, it's only money at the end of the day. I have a saying about you have to keep your spirit level. And if you do things that aren't right, that bubble starts tilting one way and it goes out of your box. And I just cannot leave my life like that. So bit by bit by bit, we just got better. And it was a long time. I reckon it was a good 2 years to really set that factory up with really good systems, processes, procedures. And we just made gains, I suppose. And today, you know, we are making 7,000 garments a week. We are making for Marks and Spencers and ASOS and Finery. And it was that work where we were just realizing actually that there was a massive skill shortage, just a massive skill shortage in the industry, which is why we opened up a stitching academy, because we wanted succession planning. And actually, even today, 80% of our ladies are East European, who were mortified by Brexit, I have to say. And that took a lot of getting them to realise that, no, the world doesn't actually think that they're illegal immigrants taking money away from the NHS, etc. It just took a lot of time for them to be stable again. So the Stitching Academy was therefore born. And how sad is it that in the country that there wasn't a stitching qualification? We actually had to write the qualification for level one and level two because it didn't even exist. So it's been a long, long, long haul and lots of ups and downs along the way. But actually, the worst down was this time last year. It just so happened that the production wasn't coming through. We hadn't done anything wrong. We had no RTMs, return to manufacturers. We had no quality issues. We just weren't really getting the orders. And it started in July. So it was July, August, September. And by October, we just had no work. But I was so loyal to the women downstairs. I didn't want to lay them off. I mean, they'd been loyal to me for 6 years stitching. Mm. So I kept trying to find new accounts and I just got myself into more and more debt. And actually this time now, December, was the worst ever trading position of the company. I mean, I actually thought we were going to go. Mm. And I mean, it's just, there must be people that listen to your program, to your podcast, who will know that you're lying in bed at night, the rivers of Babylon are upon you because you're wondering how the hell you're going to pay all the bills this week. Yeah. And I was thinking, it's Christmas, these women have got children, you know, and all our reserves, because it had started in the summer, the drying up of the orders. Yeah. All the reserves had gone, and by January, I was told by the accountant, actually, what were his words? They were so poignant. Oh, what don't you understand about critical, Jennifer? That's what he said. And it was like such a good slap in the face with a wet fish. He said, you are absolutely on your knees. What are you going to do? He said, you're going to have to look at closing the business. And this was a meeting just before Christmas. And I don't want to get the impression that I'm some kind of crybaby, but you just can't help your emotions. And I remember holding my chin because it was wobbling so much in that meeting that I actually had to leave because I was going to burst into floods of tears because I actually didn't know what to do. And then it's not often I have a row with my husband, like a big Barney of a row, but we got it back into the car after the meeting and he said something, probably along the lines of "I told you so," which doesn't help at the time. And I just exploded. I just went wild and just said, "How dare you not support me after knowing me for 35 years? And you know that I can't just walk away. I have to find a way out of this complete mess that we're in." And I was just hysterical. And I just got back home. And I walked the woods. I love walking. It just, green space to me just gives me a clear head. I think I went walking for about 2 hours and I thought, you know, I really should close the business because it was just everything was black. But after 2 hours, I thought, well, hey, what have I got to lose? What, you know, if I throw in the towel now, I'll regret that for the rest of my life. And I owed everybody money. And I just thought, I'm going to tackle it. I'm going to ring up all my suppliers. I'm going to tell them I'm in a dreadful state. But, you know, they knew me and they trusted me. And God loves them. They all did support me. And they said, as long as you give us a little bit each week, you know, and if you can't, you tell us. And I gave them my word. And actually, I kept on thinking, what have I got that I own that I can sell if I let these people down? Because that's worse than anything, and that's my dad's words again about the word is your bond. So we crawled out of horrendous financial situation, to be really honest. We just bit by bit. I had to make some people, actually only a few. I think I made like 3 people redundant. Some of the management people took salary cuts, which I really appreciated their support at that time. I told everybody that we had to have a new way of business, particularly in the factory. The FTA, the Fashion Technology Academy that we were building up, I spoke to Haringey Council, who were fantastic. They'd provided us 2 years earlier with £470,000 to open up a Fashion Technology Academy, which is a whole building of new machines to learn stitching, pressing, quality control, cutting. I mean, you know, again, how could I have walked away and let all those people down that have got confidence in us as a company? I just couldn't do it. So we just clawed our way back from the absolute brink, and it was awful. And I know that there are people that I know personally that are having that sort of time now where they just can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And you know, and my advice is just don't give up. Just keep finding a way. If you really believe that in what you're doing, if you really believe that it's right what you're doing, then don't give up. But if it's making you ill, obviously that's a completely different scenario. You know, you've got to weigh up pros and cons. So at the moment, are we in a happy place? Yes, we are. As I said, we're doing this 7, sometimes 8,000 garments a week. We've got the Fashion Technology Academy, which has got all these learners that we're working with through Job Centre Plus. So if you're in North London or East London, then these courses are free. And actually, we've just won a programme with JP Morgan, and they're allowing us for about 6 months to allow anybody to do the course for free, which I just think is wonderful.
Anyone throughout the country?
I know in London. London-based, unfortunately. So if they're in London, they can do our courses for free. And these are proper qualifications, and we don't do any rubbish, Amanda. You know, I'm very funny about my standards, and always have been.
Doesn't surprise me at all.
We've got to be the best we can. Yes. you've got to be the best we can always, and you keep stretching and challenging yourself. But, you know, there's a lady called S, that's all I'm going to say her name is, and I was talking to her recently, and she's so articulate and so bright, and I said, how come you're here? Like, how come you're on this course and you're an employee? Like, you've got so much about you and so much to give. And, you know, in like the space of 3 months in her life, she lost a job. A house was connected to her job. She lost a boyfriend, she lost her father, and then her grandfather was seriously ill. God. Now, that's that curveball, isn't it? That's that curveball that comes in your life and it takes you completely off your feet. And all the best laid plans in the world will not prepare you for that catastrophic series of events. You know, it's just, that is the sandwich man peeping his horn there, Amanda, just in case you can hear that. That's all the machinists are going to go and get their sandwiches. You know, I'm absolutely privileged that we can take this lady and we are giving her stitching skills. And she actually said to me, after that first conversation, she said, I feel as though I was destined to come here because I've always loved design. I've always loved fashion. And now I can make my own garments and I'm starting to sell to my friends. Now, all the money in the world cannot buy me that satisfaction.
I understand.
Well, I'm quite emotional talking about that now. I just think how wonderful it is that she was in absolute despair and we've given her that hope and she has something in which she can go out and change her life. I just think that is so rewarding. I love that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just dabbing my eyes. I'm just okay now. So I've got loads of those stories and they are all true and, you know, and that's the core that just in my darkest hour when, you know, things do go wrong, of course they go wrong, it's certainly not perfection in any shape, way or form, but that's what I can hold on to and it gives me that real sense of achievement. And all the people that we now employ about 107 people in total, and we have this ethos about we can do some good and we can change. You know, every little bit you do that is making things better, we can make a difference. We can all make a difference. You just can't be scared to do that.
I like that.
It's all very profound, isn't it, Amanda? It's very, very profound. But it's 100% what I believe in.
Profound. Wow. You need to write a book, Jenny.
I don't know about a book. I just think while I can, I mean, I do get up hideously early. I get up at 5 o'clock each morning. To make matters worse, I know I told you, Amanda, when I saw you, I've got a wonderful friend called Jean who, when I was 19, she let me go and live with her. I was sponsored by Rolls-Royce to do my degree and I had to move to Shrewsbury and I persuaded this poor woman to let me come and live with her for a while and she's such a lovely lady and she's her partner and Jean, they breed racehorses. And this time I went up to see her, this beautiful mare was in the field and she said, oh, you know, I told so-and-so not to race this horse this day and it's going to have to be shot. And perhaps it is because I'm an Aries by nature. I looked at this horse and I thought, that poor horse is going to be shot and it wasn't even her fault. And like, she's a beautiful mare, but she's 16'3". She's massive. And I said, oh, don't worry, Jean. I'll have her. Don't worry. And I mean, how utterly, utterly ridiculous of a, I was 53 at the time, a 53-year-old woman bouncing around on a racehorse like some sack of potatoes. I mean, I find it incredible that I'm in this position. It's too late now. And I have fallen off her, and I have broken two ribs as well, which is so painful. But I'm now on that mission. Like, I'm not giving up with this horse, and I'm going to carry on. And actually, I'm very grateful for Jean because it gives me another perspective of my life because it's so easy to people talk about this work-life balance, you know, and I look at my wonderful three children. Tom is now in the Royal Marines and he's just doing his training, which I'm very proud of, but I'm also very scared. I'm very scared about what the future holds for him. Mm. And all the awful things that are happening in the world, like Syria. And then I've got Callum and Zach, who are both very good hockey players, and they're at Loughborough, and they're doing their courses there. Mm. You know, and so this work-life balance, I've always believed I have to be really honest with my children. Actually, I'm honest with everybody. And I think a mother's role in this world is sometimes to say the things they don't want to hear. And so I'm in a family of all guys who all love football, who all love sport. And, you know, then there's me trying to hold all these things together, making sure they have good food. And I'm a lousy cook. I'm lousy. We've lived off slow cooker meals for about 10 years. But at least that was healthy. At least it was healthy for
us. Alive. So we're...
They used to say, oh, not another stew, mother, not another stew. So, you know, I'm so proud of where they are in their lives. And they're healthy, mentally well-adjusted boys. So, you know, I thank my lucky stars for that. I keep telling my husband he still loves me because I keep on reckoning the more I say it, the more he'll believe it. So I keep him going. So it's really good from that perspective. So, you know, I just think that life is indeed very precious, and it's very important to feel as though you can look at yourself in the mirror each morning. If money comes my way, then great. If it doesn't, well, hey, I've had that many times in my life. It certainly isn't the be-all and end-all about what makes you happy inside.
So I guess you're not afraid anymore of the money not coming or the money stopping, because you faced it head on, haven't you?
Yes, and I feel you're absolutely right. And you know, if I can assure anybody who's listening to your podcast now that is having financial difficulties, my God, my heart goes out to you, because it immobilizes you. It's so black and it is so dark, and you don't know which way to turn, right? It really is crippling, as is depression. And my advice is, hour by hour, day by day, you've got to get through it, and you just got to face it. I think that was the success for me, was ringing up those suppliers and saying, look, I haven't got it. It's just a really bad time. I'm not going to let you down, which, you know, was a gamble in itself, because I was never 100% sure. But whatever happens in your life, don't fight the fear. You know, work with it and go through it and make sure. I mean, I've got wonderful friends. I love my friends, Louise Carroll, who I've been to uni with, Jane Solers, who I went to primary school with. You know, I am blessed with great friends. And, you know, tears will come and tears will flow, but we're just human at the end of the day. You know, we all have weaknesses and we all have strengths, and we just got to get through those periods.
Jenny, I love how you have described all of the bumps in the road and how you've got through them. And I'm kind of stumped for a question. I guess what I want to know is, you've talked about not giving up. You've talked about facing your fears. And what I've heard as I've been listening to you is what's shone through is integrity. You've always put integrity at the heart of everything you do, that never, ever letting people down, always following through on your word. And it's almost as if, even if there might have been times when you felt like giving up personally, you wouldn't, because you don't want to let other people down, whether it's the women, your machinists, the women you're training, your suppliers, you know, anyone. And that has kept you going. But also that creativity you talked about, calling the suppliers and saying, this is the situation you're in, about getting the free shop, so much creativity. And I'm wondering, is creativity one of the keys to getting through tough times?
I think actually the key is honesty. You know, it's that It was when John, our accountant, said, "What don't you understand about critical?" You know, it was like a real wet fish in the face. Like, book up your ideas, get on with it, tackle the situation.
Yeah.
And I think it's very easy to go into denial sometimes. Oh, it's not that bad. Oh, it's not that bad. We'll sort that through. We'll have a better week next week. And it doesn't get better. It just gets worse and worse. You're so right about integrity. I listen to how people. I mean, fashion, you can imagine what fashion's like, can't you? It's very kissy and darling and all the rest of it, and that is so not me. And I do look at people and think, why would you say that or pretend that? Because it's just that honesty, isn't it? I actually think my mum's illness, when I was four, she went into that mental institution. She never came out. She was so, so poorly with electrical shock treatments. And I think she really had postnatal depression, but it just wasn't diagnosed like that in the 60s. And it's that honesty again, isn't it? If mom was honest with how she felt or how she was, or if my father had been more honest, who knows? I mean, it's such a difficult area, mental illness. But all I know is if we can be respectful and be mindless, mindfulness. You don't have to be rude to people, but you know we've got to be honest, and we've got to do what I think is the right course in life, because we're only on this earth what 70, 80, 90 years. It's insignificant, and I'd rather look back and think, you know what, that lady S who I've just been talking about. And so many other people who've managed to help and made their businesses prosper. We've been able to help lots of different people at lots of different levels. And that to me is what life is about. Just keeping that spirit level and looking at yourself and thought, yes, I've done something good today.
Absolutely wonderful. I'll remember the spirit level.
Yes, it's a nice thing to remember. And I can't believe, Amanda, that you like touched my own feelings. You've made me cry nearly twice, so I don't normally get choked up. So I've decided to be very honest with you today. And, you know, I hope my words will help other people out there. You know, and we have an open door policy. We're only in North London, close to Manor House Tube. People want to come and see us and say hello. They're very welcome. Life should be about enjoying ourselves as much as possible all the time.
Absolutely wonderful. Jenny, thank you so very much for being here today, for telling your story. And I know that there will be people who will listen to this, and it will come at just at the right time for them. You know, when we publish this, when we go live with it in the new year, because there are people who are going through adversity, as we all know, at any point in time. So, you know, there will be those who just listen to this and they'll think, okay, I'm not going to give up.
And Amanda, how wonderful is it that you do this as a service? You know, this is, you know, something that is free. You're clearly very empathetic. You're very switched on. I mean, when we were talking together, I was monopolized by you. I mean, I just didn't want to talk to anybody else. And you're very astute. You picked up on something I'd said three times. I don't know if you remember that conversation.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I was delighted that you asked me to be part of this today. And you can put me down as a big fan, Amanda.
Oh, we'll have our mutual fan club then, Jenny.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, thank you for such kind words. I shall float off now into the afternoon with that.
Okay, well, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Amanda Alexander's Inspiring Women Interviews podcast. While you're waiting for the next episode, visit amandaalexander.com and sign up free to Career Confidence 101, where you'll get 10 powerful coaching questions to help you know yourself, trust yourself, and step up to extraordinary success.